Good evening. So, as I said, this is the this is October 1st, the beginning of a busy month for our practice, kind of for our country too. So it's an interesting time to be alive. But I want to. I don't want to make a broad statement about that, but I would like to say something about the practice period. One time, somewhere, somebody said to me, I really feel happy that you have a daily meditation practice. And I was happy that that person was happy because I have a daily meditation practice, and I at the same time I wished for them that they would have a daily meditation practice. That was my wish for them, and it seemed like they were happy I had one, but they said there was some barrier, some obstacle for them to have the daily meditation practice. So, you know, a study period or a practice period, which you can sign up for, which I don't know if I even put these sign-up sheets out, but someone can do that at the end of the evening, is an opportunity to... you know, to recommit to some sort of shape of practice for yourself. Now, maybe you have a very settled, you know, defined practice, and I'm not suggesting that you need to mess with that at all. In the past, in this Sangha, this was a long time ago, but we took on actual, you know, goals of sitting so many hours and during the practice period, but that was a practice that some other Zen center had taken up. But after several years of trying that, we thought, no, that's not really the way that we grew up in practice. So, you know, this is a practice where we don't really tell people what their practice is or what to do exactly, but we do invite you. We do invite you, and we're happy for you if you have some kind of defined meditation practice. So study period is an opportunity to engage in that, and you can have a study period buddy, and you could come to these lectures and talks, and or you could listen to them online if you're not real close by, and you know, participate for 6 weeks or so. I think we go till November the 12th. So, just a kind of time to draw in and re-engage. And the fall is a good time for that because, you know, there's this change in the air right in the fall, and we're heading into, you know, a darker season and so forth. And sometimes that turn towards the fall is a little unsettling. I invite you to do that, and there's other things that can go along with that, like having a talk with me. You're having a talk with Mio, reading the book that we're studying for, that we're looking at. I see Will has a copy of it in his lap. It's called 30 Verses. It's called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara by a Zen priest who lives around or in the Minnesota Zen Center. And this is, I think, quite an approachable book, and so although it is a very, you know, it's a very deep topic, very, some, in some ways is a very hard topic to approach and describe and to elucidate in some way that stimulates your practice, but we'll make some endeavors in that direction. I was reading recently, somebody sent me my job description as the Tonto, and it says one of the things that I'm supposed to do is pick study topics that are, you know, I'm supposed to gauge the readiness of the Sangha for study, and I'm supposed to pick topics that the Sangha is ready to engage in. I'm not positive that I've done that this time, but I tend to selfishly pick things that I'd like to study and I'm interested in, and see if we can all come along for the ride. And it appears that this book is a good place to start. So, and this book is on the 30 verses on consciousness only that were written by Vasubandhu, a great thinker. Some people put him in the same category as Nagarjuna. He was considered in the second century or so. He was considered the second Buddha, and Vasubandhu gets classed with him in various traditions, because Vasubandhu wrote something called the Abhidharma Kosha, and he wrote these 30 verses. And he's credited with quite a few other writings. So this term, where the book says, inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, so I'll start with this term, Yogacara. The literal translation of that term is yoga practice. And this is not... of course, today in America and all around the world, yoga practice is very popular, but it's a little different because it's that more associated with the physical asanas and breath work. So people engage that kind of yoga, that kind of yoga is meant to yoga means to yoke. And the intent of the physical kind of yoga is to, as I understand it, to yoke body and mind, bring body and mind into one straightforward endeavor, and a feeling of peace and ease and settledness and. This kind of yogacara is not so much different in a way, because what it certainly means to head in the direction of peace and ease, and it means to take us in that direction through the practice of meditation. So through the practice of a meditative awareness, the centering, collecting practice of meditative awareness, mission, but I don't think that's right. The right word. So,
aspiration.
Yeah. Thank you. The aspiration of Yogacara is to unite, and Yogacara is particularly concerned with the apparent function of consciousness, which is to divide, to make subject and object appear as two different things. And the basic stance of Yogacara is that the whole function of consciousness is like these glasses, that consciousness itself is kind of like a lens through which we inevitably see subject and object divided, perceiver and perceived divided, and so Yogacara is wanting to educate and help us understand how consciousness is functioning and really get down into the weeds and the traditional presentation, as Ben Connolly talks about, the traditional presentation of Buddhism is that we can describe six consciousnesses. And this is mainstream Buddhist teaching, is that there are six consciousnesses, the five sense consciousness plus mind. So that's all Buddhist schools agree on this. And we, in our Zen practice, we chant the Heart Sutra and we mention these six. We say in emptiness, they can't be found, but we certainly do mention them, and we do call attention to them. So, but Yogacara comes along and it has this innovation, and the innovation is that they're not six consciousnesses, there are eight consciousnesses, and we're going to explore these very, especially I think next week we will talk about the additional two consciousnesses, because according to the Yogacara teaching, the way that the 30 verses are structured, the base consciousness or the alaya is the root consciousness from which tied in to and on the top of which the other consciousnesses arise. When I was reading Ben Connolly's book, I made a note in the margin of the book at one point, and I said, the root consciousness, alaya, is like a mycelium. So mycelium is what mushrooms grow out of, and I think in the verse, I didn't bring the verse up here, but I think the verse says something like its contents are unknown. It's like hidden, right? The root consciousness is hidden. Well, that's kind of like, oh, thank you. Yeah. It says, the first of these consciousnesses that he mentioned, the first of the consciousnesses, the store consciousness, contains all karmic seeds. What it holds and its perception of location are unknown. So I have this image of the mycelium of mushrooms, and I've read that like the mycelium is, it can be just this vast, vast, vast area, and in the various places, the mushrooms, in this case, the mushrooms of the self, the mushrooms of the self, self-consciousness, pop out of this mycelium. I think it's a good analogy. And then also the sixth sense consciousness also rise on top of the root consciousness. So I tend to need images to help me comprehend some of these things. This seemed like a good image, that a lie is hidden underground, can't see it, its contents are unknown, but it gives rise to the self. How often do we say, when, for instance, anger arises in us, how often do we say, where did that come from? Have you ever had that experience? Or some, you act in some way, or you say something, and anyway, it's happened to me. I confess that it's happened to me, and I thought, where did that come from? And so maybe the Yogacara explanation is this comes from, you know, this comes from this vast underground self. It's a vast underground self. So the 30 verses are not the only text that's been written in the Yogacara school. There are other texts, but it is the one that's the best known. The title, as we see here, it says the 30 verses on consciousness only, and consciousness only is not the translation of Yogacara. Yogacara. I'm not quite sure how Yogacara came to be used for the overall name of the school, but consciousness only is a more dedicated name for this teaching. The word in Sanskrit is Vijnanavada. So Vijnana means consciousness. It's the sixth. It's what mind consciousness in the list of the six sense consciousness is vijnana. So vijnana means consciousness, and vada means only or just consciousness or only consciousness. So this is 30 verses on consciousness only. And the word vijnana is an interesting word, because it can also be etymologized. It can be broken down and into jhana or jnana, I think jnana, which means knowledge or knowing, and vi, which means split or divided. Split or divided. So consciousness only is the sense of it is that what we have, what we get when we get consciousness, when we get born with consciousness, is divided knowing. That's our situation. That's the setup. And the setup is that we have a consciousness that is born, I recently heard a story on the radio. It was really interesting about they did an experiment on very small. It was a kind experiment, but it was some kind of test or experiment on very small infants, and I don't remember exactly how they set it up, but their thesis was that even very small infants will express a preference if you test for this. And indeed, they did their test, and they saw that even very small infants are engaged in picking and choosing. So picking and choosing is really based, expressing a preference is really based on this division of subject and object. So this is the setup for us in what's called samsara, the wandering worldly life that's associated with suffering. Go ahead. If I can answer it.
Just whatever your thoughts might be. So I'm a little resistant to the idea of a mind as being root consciousness on which these other six are based.
Mm-hmm.
Because sentience is evolution. evolutionarily an early innovation, and it's there are many sentient beings who I don't think have an alliance. Worms, crabs.
Hmm.
So there's in my mind there's a I'm not quite able to bridge that disconnect. It would seem more like the sense consciousness is very archaic, at least awareness of sensory, responsiveness to sensory inputs. And somewhere along the line, beings became sophisticated enough that karmic activity could take place. That's just my thought.
Well, I don't think necessarily that the idea of evolution or something like that was not really extant when Vasubandhu was writing, and he was writing basically for human beings. So he was attempting to describe the setup for human beings, and also he had been steeped in Abhidharma, which he basically is the father of, not exactly the father, but he was very much a part of the Abhidharma movement before he actually converted to the Mahayana and started talking like this, and so he was very steeped in the idea of this accumulation of karma. And I don't know if he's credited with the invention of the alaya as a storehouse of karmic seeds, but I think maybe so, that he is the inventor of that. In that alaya there can be both good karma and bad karma. Well, the mycelium model is my invention, so and I'm not Vasubandhu, but the texts do clearly, the verses do clearly indicate that, for instance, the self, manas, is dependent on store consciousness and takes it as its object, and then the five sense consciousness arise on the root consciousness together or separately, depending on conditions like waves arising on water. So there's another image. If we can throw out mycelium and just go, waves arising on water. But the clear thrust of this is that these other six are born, or seven actually, are born on top of the alaya.
The way the yogis get together is that sensory capability arose very early in Vasubandhu's time. You could see it in many life forms. But maybe like sense consciousness is more than, at least the way Vasubandhu is using it, is more than eye consciousness, is more than eye, object, and seeing. That seeing is a particular kind of awareness, consciousness, which is informed by the alaya.
Right.
So I'm straying with distinction between the physical act of seeing, which is accomplished by many lower life forms, and the way humans see, which is arises out of karmic dispositions.
that arises. Yeah. Okay. So we can struggle with that question. Yeah. I'm not sure I can speak to it, but what I did want to speak to was I wanted to begin to approach the way that really to talk about this central idea of consciousness only, and explore that a little bit and try to bring it into try to bring it into relationship with our actual Zen practice, because I think it's this is not exactly, I mean, this teaching had an influence on Zen, but it's not Zen teaching per se, but it had a big influence on Zen because it points Zen is a tradition that points directly to the human mind, right? And that kind of understanding of what Zen is it really arises out of this Yogacara teaching. So I was not going to necessarily start right at the beginning of the verses, although we will later go to the beginning and start in a logical order, but a sequential order. I wanted to bring to your attention verse 26, which is it makes the interesting statement that as long as consciousness does not rest in projection only, the tendencies of the grasping self and others, self and other will not cease. As long as consciousness does not rest in projection only, the tendency of grasping self and other will not cease. So I see puzzled looks. Yeah. So, yeah.
Could you read that one more time?
As long as consciousness does not rest in projection only, the tendencies of grasping self and other will not cease. This verse seems to be saying that as long as divided knowing, if we say that consciousness is divided knowing, as long as divided knowing, the knowing that separates subject and object, does not rest in an understanding that divided knowing is how things are, then you will not be able to overcome this division that the, or this grasping, this tendencies of grasping.
Does it say rest or rest in an understanding?
I added the rest in an understanding.
You caught you doing that.
Yes, I did. You caught me doing that. Here's my take on this. When we sit zazen, we don't sit saying, "I am one. I am one. I am not grasping. I am not grasping." We don't do that. That is not the teaching for our sitting meditation. We sit with the mind that we have. We sit still and let what arises arise. We sit with the mind we have, which is projection only, and endeavor to let ourselves rest there. In the midst of the turbulence of consciousness. So consciousness is a given. Consciousness is always producing subject and object division. That's what the business or the function of consciousness is. And so Zazen is about, we're not trying to, overcome that. We actually are trying to, we bow to consciousness. Consciousness is creating a knowing subject and a known object. That's what its business is. And we sit letting that happen. We don't mess with that. And not messing with that process is resting in projection only. We rest in the truth that that's the way things are. We don't immediately go in zazen and everything is settled and everything is not moving. In fact, we see that things are moving. We're always kind of in an unstable place, and we just sit with that. We don't try to manufacture some other awareness. And if we don't manufacture some other awareness, then we're actually resting in this truth that what consciousness is projection only. It's a consciousness that functions that way, and we rest in the truth that that's what it does without messing with it. Question?
Yes. I'm trying to latch on to how you're using projection only.
Well, that's Mr. Connolly likes to call it projection only.
I'd like to find out if my understanding is correct in that it sounds like what you're saying is that by projection only, what we know is only our idea of what's out there, as opposed to what it actually is, because I don't know that.
Yes, that's what consciousness only means, is that we only see the mental picture of what's out there. We don't see the real. Consciousness doesn't let, you know, the way our consciousness is set up, it doesn't. We don't see our version of what's external is simply our version of what is external, our idea of what is external, and when we rest in that, the idea that, well, what is external is just, I'm just making that up, then we can be very, we might have a consensus that Raphael and I are making things up the same way. He and I might agree that the floor is brown or something like that. So, many minds may agree on the way that we're making things up, but there are other areas of our lives where it's very helpful to, and I think practice gives us understanding that this is just my understanding of things, and we see all the time, if we live with others, if we see how they don't react to the stimuli, that the same stimuli the same way. They don't respond in the same way. They haven't completely, one of us, one person, something may happen and they may be afraid, and the other person, the same thing can happen with the person who's right with them, and they're not afraid. So this is this idea of the kind of responsibility we have, as practitioners, to take care of our consciousness and acknowledge this aspect of projection only, that we are responsible for the way we respond, to not expect that everybody else is responding the very same way to the things that we're afraid of or angry about or happy about or et cetera, and when we do that, we can let others have other reactions, and we can not get mad at them, or we can, go right along with them. John?
Is the practice that we rest in consciousness only, we rest in projection only, or is it there is rest in projection only, there is rest in consciousness only?
Yes. That's where rest is. That's where rest is.
So you said projection only is an aspect of consciousness.
Projection only is the way that consciousness functions.
So it's only projection only. There's no other way that consciousness can exist other than projecting.
Yes, that's the teaching here, as I understand it. There's always a screen, you know, and there's always a lens, and so we receive, you know, various stimuli, but consciousness is always dividing that reception into self and others.
No,
self and other.
Maybe those eight, that's the function of the eight consciousnesses, but the other day we were hearing from Kokyo about another kind of awareness. It's what the Tibetans call Rigpa, bare awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and in fact, the verses, as I recall, although I don't have it at my fingertips, say something like, in enlightenment, manas is not to be found.
Right.
So I think there is another awareness, or I'll say awareness, the words are tricky, but let's say awareness, separate from these eight consciousnesses, which can be free of the imputational functions of consciousness.
You know, so this is, you know, this is the risk, you know, of bringing up a topic like this is that, and, you know, truthfully, in, you know, Buddhist history, there's been great debates about these things, you know, and so you know, what I hope to accomplish was that we might see how this actually worked in our sitting meditation practice. Yes, Clem.
Yes, I'm very curious about where the screen you describe resides.
Mm.
Because you have, you know, like your eye, you have the organ, you have the thing that you see, which is its object. You have the awareness. Then you have, you know, good, bad, and different. Where's the screen versus projecting on?
Yeah, you can't see it.
I exactly see it. I just want to know where in the chain of my being aware of you, for example,
I can't say where it is.
Where do you see me? You can say that.
Yeah. Where do I see you? I see you. Where do I see you? That is the question. You know, I see you like when Kokyo, he was here, he was talking about, you know, how far away are you? You know, are you 10 feet away from me, or you know, and that's what perception is doing. Perception is always making up a story about location and that sort of thing. But, you know, again, this is the risk, you know, I ran to bring up this kind of topic, because we, you know, the point is not to get balled up in you know, sort of a philosophical positions, or the point is to grapple with some of these teachings without maybe, you know, in the light of our practice, And for instance, I was going to bring up the fact that, I'll just bring up this quote from Suzuki Roshi, and I see that I may soon be saved by the bell, but he said, we don't make much distinction between things that exist outside and things that exist within ourselves. We don't make much distinction between things that exist outside and things that exist within ourselves. You may say something exists outside of yourself. You may feel that it does, but it isn't true. When you say there is a river, the river already exists in your mind. A hasty person may say, the river is over there. Clem is over there. But if you think about it, you will find that the river is in your mind as a kind of thought. That things exist outside ourselves is a dualistic, primitive, shallow understanding of things. So this, he wasn't saying this is the Yogacara position when he said this, but this is the Yogacara position. This is exactly the Yogacara position. And I came across a scholar, a contemporary scholar of the Yogacara named Thomas Wood, who wrote a book called Mind Only, and he uses in this his definition of what this school is about. He says he uses Vijñanavada or consciousness only, but he says, according to our ordinary way of thinking, sensory perception gives us knowledge of a world that is external to ourselves. According to the Vijñanavada, this ordinary way of thinking is a serious error and the primary cause of our continued suffering. According to the Vijñanavada, what we call sensory impressions imagine only themselves. That all that people perceive are their own precepts. So this, I hear this teaching as a very humbling teaching. I hear this as a teaching to, not be so sure about our perceptions. We're making, through our consciousness, we're making up a story about the external world. The teaching of the, as I understand, the teaching of this consciousness only school is to be keenly aware that we are always making up a story about the external world, and that's what consciousness does. That's what consciousness does. And from a practice standpoint, we to be aware of our story that we're making up as story, as story, we know there are many stories, and so if we don't cling too strongly, if the teaching is, be aware that it's a story, be rather careful about it. Don't hold on to it too tightly. Don't cling to it. Right? This we hear all the time, and this is what I hear from a practice standpoint in this teaching. It goes deep into our perceptual processes, not just our emotional or relational, but deep into our perceptual processes. Yeah, Peter.
I've been wondering, I'll even, what is the purpose of the word only? And just now, I'm wanting to suggest perhaps that it's the consciousness made the story up all by itself. I'm curious if you would just speak to the word only.
Well, the word only in this understanding, as I understand it, is that we only see what our consciousness tells us, essentially. We only see that. We don't see reality. Now, you know, this teaching is a teaching really, most of this teaching is a teaching of how we are caught, you know, how we are caught in the subject object, you know, the knower known division. You know, at the very end of the 30 verses, it says that, you know, essentially that the Buddha's wisdom, you know, overcomes this division, but it really overcomes this division by resting in consciousness only, by resting there, you know, by not fighting it, because when to rest in consciousness only is to completely accept that all that we perceive are our own precepts, that all we perceive are our own precepts, and when we completely rest in mind only, then there's actually the possibility of no further division, I think. You know, that's my understanding. No further messing with things. No further, messing with things. So, yeah. Would you like to say more about that?
I see. We're treading into very difficult
terrain. And the way we tread into that terrain is with a discerning mind, trying to figure it out. And ultimately, it can't be figured out. And so that resting place comes from that act of faith that I don't have to figure it out. I can just rest.
Okay, great. And I totally agree. And, you know, you can read this book by Ben Connolly. He makes a valiant effort to simplify these teachings. He may be making, you know, somewhat of a leap of faith in the way that he simplifies. But the most important thing is to rest. You know, if reading this book or hearing about these teachings or talking about these teachings causes, you know, more unrest in you or discord in you, then you should just drop it. Yeah, you know, just drop it and don't engage with them because that's not the point. The point is to make us aware of the primacy of consciousness and its power, I would say. It's the power of consciousness and to be aware that there is this you know, dividing and imagining function of consciousness that's going on, and we need to be engaged with an understanding of that, to be resting in an acceptance of projection only, then I believe that can be a healing practice and I believe that that's the direction that Zazen points us in. In Zazen we tend towards not contending with the objects of experience. The objects of the experience keep rising up, and if we surround those objects of experience with patience and calm and the virtues of our practice, eventually they relax, they relax. And like I was saying to Kokio, when we're sitting in meditation, it's the particular keeps coming, and then maybe it stops and it comes and it stops and it comes, and after a while, maybe when we're sitting for a long day, the perceived is not bothering us, it's more at rest, and when the particular stops coming, then this apparent division between something that's observing the particular, a mind that's observing this particular, if there's nothing to observe, then the mind drops away. There's nothing coming, and so the mind can rest, the mind can drop away. Body and mind can drop away, and that's where we really rest. We observe that consciousness keeps sending us stuff until it doesn't, until it quiets down, and then when it quiets down, then when objects quiet down, when the particular quiets down, then we can rest.
The more words that I put into what you're saying, the more difficult it will be for me to get a good understanding. But what I do perceive in what you're sharing and what the book and what the verses are saying is that if I rest on what I see, then I will miss out on what I'm seeing. And so reality is never resting, it's always moving. So it's not what I see, but what I can be seeing. And it's not what I know, but what I can be knowing. Because if I rest or I stop with what I know, then I won't be knowing, because reality is always flowing, it's unfolding. So it's more of being in the knowing and in the seeing than in the know or the see.
Yeah, Kokio talked about being in the experiencing versus the experienced, So he was kind of talking about, we have the experienced and the experiencer, and the middle way is the middle way is experiencing, there's some middle way in experiencing, That's like 5 to 9. The main thing, I think, you know, is just, you know, if you have the book, maybe this, you say, oh, well, I didn't understand anything Jim talked about, but I want to see what he was trying to talk about. So you could, you know, look at the book. Those who may be so inclined could come 8 o'clock in the morning on Thursdays, where we will probably take a very deep dive into the book itself and, you know, kind of go chapter by chapter or something like that. So if it's possible, you could join us at 8 o'clock on Thursday mornings after Zazen, or you don't have to come to Zazen, but Zazen's at 6 and or 6:40, and then we'll talk. We'll be talking sort of, you know, chapter by chapter. You take what you need and you leave the rest from these teachings. Okay, so you know, don't get discouraged by my fumbling with this material. Read for yourself, and if you want, or you know, just do your practice. Just do, you know, your daily practice, and what you're doing really in daily practice is you're letting go of objects moment after moment after moment, and then when you do that moment after moment, it seems like you can rest.
What do you think about the idea that everything that Vasubandhu put down, we've been studying all along, and if we don't have met even a little bit of Dogen, we've got Vasubandhu there?
Well, I think that the more I study this, the more I can make linkage. I can see connections to our practice, to our Zen teaching. Certainly, you know, like the quote from Suzuki Roshi. I mean, he's connecting back to the Yogacara in that. And like today when I was studying. Oh, this is the last thing I'm going to say. I promise. Today when I was studying, I thought when erroneous imaginations cease, this is from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, when the erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. Well, I didn't get to talk about Vikalpa at all, which was in my notes, but Vikalpa is imagining. And the 30 verses has a great deal of talk about the, you know, that this is, that consciousness only is a process of imagination. It's an imagining process. So when erroneous imaginations that divide subject and object, which is what this kind of imagination does. When those cease, the acquiescent mind, the resting acquiescent mind, realizes itself. It realizes that it's consciousness only.